The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What was your intention when you wrote The Things They Carried?
Well, there were numerous intentions, not just one. I think one was simply to demonstrate through a story the power that story has in our lives, to give us models of proper human behavior and to make us feel, through story, a little more attached to our own lives. You read about someone else's life in a story. If it's a good enough story, it'll finally make you consider your own life and what the dramas of being a human being, the joys, the tragedies. Another aim, because I was a soldier in Vietnam and went through the nightmare of watching friends die and watching civilians die in Vietnam, to raise a cautionary note about war in general. It's not a political thing, a rhetorical. It's simply to have people think once or twice about, are we doing the right thing and going to this war and killing people and watching our own children die in these wars? I'm not a pacifist, but I'm also not a bellicose kind of person, partly because of what I went through in Vietnam. And another, probably the final motive when I tell stories is simply to entertain on a high level, I hope. But when I'm reading a book or seeing a movie or looking at a piece of art, something in me feels good about kind of the what nextness of things. And it inspires me to think and to be bold in my own life.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Tim O'Brien, author of The Things They Carried, seven other novels, and a memoir. What is the difference between what you call story truth and happening truth?
Well, a literal truth or a happening truth would be my dad died recently. In the last days and hours of his life, I could have gone into that hospital room and I could have taken him in my arms and I could have said, Dad, I love you. I didn't do any of those things. The literal happening truth was I tried to avoid the topic of his imminent death and I tried to avoid anything emotional, partly because of my Minnesota background and Midwestern reticence. But a story truth, my dad can just sit up from the dead in a story, and he can put his arms out, put them around me, and say, that's okay, I know you love me. It didn't happen, but even as I uttered those words now, they make me feel love for my dad and make me remember him through an imagined event, one that never happened, one that I guess I wish had happened. And that's, I think, part of where stories, at least my stories, come from. I'm not limited by what happened. I can write about what could have happened or what should have happened.
So it's cathartic for you to write that down and have a different reality.
It is.
Your first book was a memoir, though.
Mm-hmm. It was. I was young when I wrote it. I was fresh out of Vietnam, really. In fact, parts of that book were written in Vietnam. It's not that I don't like the book, but it's not art. It's honest, and it's a record of what I went through as a soldier. But it isn't elevated by imagination in any way, and it feels a little, to me, like most memoirs do, sort of walking the standard bases for basic training, off to war, indoctrination under fire. Kind of a standard American record of what young men go through as they, you know, are pulled out of our towns and cities and sent off to fight. It felt too standard. As a work of art, it pales beside my other books, I think.
Let's go back to your father for a minute. I think I read somewhere that he wrote some stories that were published, I think, in the New York Times. He was an insurance salesman who was in World War II when that was happening. Was that kind of an example that set you up to be a writer, or do you think you would have been a writer anyway?
It's a great question to which I have no answer. I'll never know. I do remember seeing a couple of these when I was 8 or 9 years old, and I opened up a dresser drawer in my mom and dad's bedroom, and I saw one of these. And it was kind of a chipper, Gene Kelly-ish, you know, jovial look at a terrible thing. My dad, he would look on the bright side of virtually everything. There was nothing about the terror of kamikaze. He was in the Navy off at Iwo Jima and Okinawa. There was nothing scary about it. He made it seem bright, full of jokes and so on. And sort of like watching On the Town or a Gene Kelly movie from that era. But I was mightily impressed. My dad was linguistically gifted, and he was a graceful writer. And I think he had yearned to be a writer, but was trapped by circumstance, having a family and having to make money, basically. He was a well-read man. There were books always in the house. He was on our library board in my hometown. He was doing a job that was not in any way literary. He was really as much a literary man as any college professor. Maybe better read than some.
And you, after you got back from Vietnam, you went to graduate school and then worked as a newspaper reporter for a while. Why did you leave that? What was the transition point that propelled you toward becoming a full-time writer?
Well, from the time I was 8 or 9, I dreamed of being a novelist. I mean, a fiction writer, short stories and novels. But it seemed to be almost an impossible dream that I came from a little dinky town in southern Minnesota, and there were no writers around me. No one aspired to it. Literature wasn't much valued in this small town. And it seemed to me as a kid that it was something that was done by people in Philadelphia or L.A. or New York and not by somebody from Worthington, Minnesota. And I kept writing throughout my high school and college years and during graduate school, but it was a sort of secret hobby that I didn't tell many people about it. I told some that that's what I aspired to. In grad school, I was in a totally different field. I was studying American politics. This is after Vietnam. But late at night in my dorm room during grad school, I would write for maybe 2 or 3 hours from maybe, you know, midnight until 2 or 3 in the morning. And gradually a book emerged from this. I hadn't set out to write a book, but one came out of it. The pages just accumulated. And one day a friend of mine said, "Why don't you send this to a publisher?" And it really hadn't much occurred to me. I mean, it had a little, but not in a serious way. And he'd read it and said, "It's good, and you should try publishing it." And I did it kind of on a dare, but also kind of, you know, secretly hoping it would be taken. And it was that kind of minuscule, almost petty turning point, just a friend suggesting something that determined, in a way, the course of the rest of my life, just an offhand comment. And part of when I'm writing, I write about that. I write about little tiny things that occur in our lives that at the moment we don't know are going to be important and may seem even trivial, but end up being launching pads for the rest of our lives. And that moment in that dorm room when he said those words to me was one of them.
And yet you had those pages ready to go.
I did.
Because you were doing it every day. I've heard that some soldiers have taken a copy of the things they carried to Afghanistan and Iraq with them. What do you think about that?
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, I hear that anecdote from lots and lots of people through emails and letters and so on that find their way to me. I kind of wish that when I was in Vietnam, I'd had a similar kind of book to carry around with me. The literature that had preceded me was mostly, how do I say this in a tactful way, but celebratory of war and kind of, you know, go do it, and it's macho kind of books. Not all of it, but a lot of it. And a book such as The Things They Carried, I think would have made me feel a little less alone, that someone had gone through something I'd gone through. And so my hope for the soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq is that they may feel a little less alone, that someone else endured what they're enduring, the landmines and the IEDs and not knowing who your enemy is and being caught in essentially civil wars where you can very rarely tell friend from enemy. All that is so different from my dad's war, where you knew who the enemy was in World War II. They wore uniforms, and there was a sense of destination. My dad was heading for Tokyo, and in the European theater, our troops were heading for Berlin. But we didn't have any of that, nor do our soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq. And the blessing of it all for me is that maybe in some small level, a man or a woman now in Afghanistan may read the things they carried and just feel supported and, as I said, less alone.
Acknowledged.
Yeah.
They could also be really grateful that they don't have those giant snakes.
I've often thought of that. I mean, they do have sandstorms, but I'll take the sandstorms over those snakes.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with award-winning author Tim O'Brien. If you just tuned in, you can hear what you missed online. There's audio at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link on our Facebook page. We'll be back to talk about the work of writing good sentences and hear Tim read a passage from The Things They Carried. Stay with us. Is there something people are not asking you that you really wish they would?
Yes. I mean, it's not exactly a question, but it's an area of interest they don't seem to have. That the things they carried, like all my other books, some of which I think are better than The Things They Carried, were made with painstaking, second by second, hour upon hour, day upon day, year upon year labor, just working hard. Not on the things that people are interested in, not on what's the story going to be, and not on characterization, but rather on sentences, making sentences. That word instead of that word, and that verb instead of that verb, and the rhythm of the language. That in the end, you can make up the best plot ever invented, and your characters can be really compelling. But if the language fails, the characters fail and the plot fails. It's like the language is the ocean or the water upon which the story kind of floats. But if the language is melodramatic or full of potholes or ugly or all the mistakes that can be made, everything goes down. The story is no good anymore, even though it would, in theory, be good, but without the language to support it. And that's where all the work goes. It goes into just painstaking, meticulous, often frustrating, hard work of trying to write fresh, graceful sentences that are not flowery or not decorative, but have energy in them that feels as I'm writing the sentence that something new that I brought into the world, and not stale and not mediocre. And very little attention is paid to that by, you know, people who ask me questions. I think they think that these books come sort of full blown into the world. They're sort of born as, you know, they're done the way a baby might be born, but they're not. I sometimes wish that there were college courses that were called Words, where all you do is you learn, every day you learn a new word, but you say it aloud and then you use it in conversation. That words are these tactile, almost like objects, like you could pick a word up, like the word emphasis, and then find ways of using the word. There's a beauty to it, and then if you have a really appropriate adjective to describe the emphasis, there's a beauty in it that's sort of beyond meaning. It just sounds beautiful, and as an object seems to me is beautiful. And the title, The Things They Carried, is an example. I mean, the word carried was what made me write the book, just the word carried. I carried myself with dignity. Carry on, the lieutenant said. There are all kinds of meanings for the word carry. Your voice carried, you know, into the next room. And when I'm writing, my attention is not always on that character doing that, but it's on that word doing that.
It's somewhat like you can build a house. All the materials are there. You can pick them up and put them in a certain order and use this material here and that material there, and you can come out with a house. But someone who has art in mind when they build a house comes out with a different kind of house.
That's really it. Yeah. It's my goal, like all writers who are any good, is art. Your aim, your aspiring, even though you may fail. You may write a clumsy book or many of them, but if you aspire to art, that's the joy of it all, is to go beyond the mediocre and to go beyond the common and or the stale, that which you've encountered a million times before. And it's what, even at my advanced age now, keeps me going, is that there's a summit that I know I'll never reach the top of this peak, but to move toward it is, for me, the joy of it all. And then to have every now and then to have a reader say, I liked it, and I liked it for reasons of art or beauty. And I know that might sound highfalutin, you know, to listeners, but it's, for me, makes my life worth living to just try to follow in those footsteps.
Well, let's hear how you've put some of those words together. In the last chapter of The Things They Carried, let's just hear a few bits from that.
This is the beginning of the last chapter. The chapter is called The Lives of the Dead. But this too is true. Stories can save us. I'm 43 years old and a writer now. And even still, right here, I keep dreaming Linda alive. And Ted Lavender too, and Kiowa, and Kurt Lemon, and a slim young man I killed, and an old man sprawled beside a pig pen, and several others whose bodies I once lifted and dumped into a truck. They're all dead. But in a story, which is a kind of dreaming, the dead sometimes smile and sit up and return to the world. And then a little later in the same chapter, there's this passage. The thing about a story is that you dream it as you tell it, hoping that others might then dream along with you. And in this way, memory and imagination and language combine to make spirits in the head. There is the illusion of aliveness. In Vietnam, for instance, Ted Lavender had a habit of popping 4 or 5 tranquilizers every morning. It was his way of coping, just dealing with the realities. And the drugs helped to ease him through the days. I can remember how peaceful his eyes were. Even in bad situations, he had a soft, dreamy expression on his face, which was what he wanted, a kind of escape. How's the war today? Somebody would ask, and Ted Lavender would give a little smile to the sky and say, mellow. A nice, smooth war today. And then in April, he was shot in the head outside the village of Tonkay. Kiowa and I and a couple of others were ordered to prepare his body for the dust-off. I remember squatting down, not wanting to look, but then looking. Lavender's left cheekbone was gone. There was a swollen blackness around his eye. Quickly, trying not to feel anything, we went through the kids' pockets. I remember wishing I had gloves. It wasn't the blood I hated. It was the deadness. We put his personal effects in a plastic bag and tied the bag to his arm. We stripped off the canteens and ammo, all the heavy stuff, and wrapped him up in his own poncho and carried him out to a dry paddy and laid him down. For a while, nobody said much. Then Mitchell Sanders laughed and looked over at the green plastic poncho. "Hey, Lavender," he said, "how's the war today?" There was a short quiet. "Mellow," somebody said. "Well, that's good," Sanders murmured. "That's real, real good. Stay cool now." "Hey, no sweat. I'm mellow." "Well, just ease on back, then. Don't need no pills. We got this incredible chopper on call. This once-in-a-lifetime mine trip." "Oh, yeah, mellow." Mitchell Sanders smiled. "There it is, my man. This chopper gonna take you up high and cool, gonna relax you, gonna alter your whole perspective on this sorry shit." We could almost see Ted Lavender's dreamy blue eyes. We could almost hear him. "Roger that," somebody said. "I'm ready to fly." There was the sound of the wind, the sound of birds, and the quiet afternoon, which was the world we were in. That's what a story does. The bodies are animated. You make the dead talk. They sometimes say things like, "Roger that." Or they say, "Timmy, stop crying," which is what Linda said to me after she was dead. And then it's the very conclusion of the final chapter, the conclusion of the book, really. Lying in bed at night, I made up elaborate stories to bring Linda alive in my sleep. I invented my own dreams. It sounds impossible, I know, but I did it. I'd picture somebody's birthday party, a crowded room, I'd think, and a big chocolate cake with pink candles. And then, soon, I'd be dreaming it. And after a while, Linda would show up, as I knew she would. And in the dream, we'd look at each other and not talk much, because we were shy. And then later, I'd walk her home, and we'd sit on her front steps and stare at the dark and just be together. She'd say amazing things sometimes. "Once you're alive," she'd say, "you can't ever be dead." Or she'd say, "Do I look dead?" It was a kind of self-hypnosis, partly willpower, partly faith, which is how stories arrive. But back then, it felt like a miracle. My dreams had become a secret meeting place, and in the weeks after she died, I couldn't wait to fall asleep at night. I began going to bed earlier and earlier, sometimes even in bright daylight. My mother, I remember, finally asked about it at breakfast one morning. "Timmy, what's wrong?" she said. But all I could do was shrug and say, "Nothing. I just need sleep, that's all." I didn't dare tell the truth. It was embarrassing, I suppose, but it was also a precious secret, like a magic trick, where if I tried to explain it or even talk about it, the thrill and mystery would be gone. I didn't want to lose Linda. She was dead. I understood that. After all, I'd seen her body. And yet, even as a 9-year-old, I had begun to practice the magic of stories. Some I just dreamed up. Others I wrote down, the scenes and dialogue. And at nighttime, I'd slide into sleep, knowing that Linda would be there waiting for me. Once I remember we went ice skating late at night, tracing loops and circles under yellow floodlights. Later we sat by a wood stove in the warming house, all alone. And after a while, I asked her, what it was like to be dead. Apparently, Linda thought it was a silly question. She smiled and said, "Do I look dead?" I told her no. She looked terrific. I waited a moment, then asked again, and Linda made a soft little sigh. I could smell our wool mittens drying on the stove. For a few seconds, she was quiet. "Well, right now," she said, "I'm not dead. But when I am, it's like, I don't know. I guess it's like being inside a book that nobody's reading." "A book," I said. "An old one. It's up on a library shelf, so you're safe at everything. But the book hasn't been checked out for a long, long time. All you can do is wait. Just hope somebody will pick it up and start reading." Linda smiled at me. "Anyway, it's not so bad," she said. "I mean, when you're dead, you just have to be yourself." She stood up and put on her red stocking cap. "This is stupid. Let's go skate some more." So I followed her down to the frozen pond. It was late. Nobody else was there. And we held hands and skated almost all night under the yellow lights. And then it becomes 1990. I'm 43 years old and a writer now, still dreaming Linda alive in exactly the same way. She's not the embodied Linda. She's mostly made up with a new identity and a new name, like the man who never was. Her real name doesn't matter. She was 9 years old. I loved her. And then she died. And yet right here, in the spell of memory and imagination, I can still see her, as if through ice, as if I'm gazing into some other world, a place where there are no brain tumors and no funeral homes, where there are no bodies at all. I can see Kiowa, too, and Ted Lavender and Kurt Lemon. And sometimes I could even see Timmy skating with Linda under the yellow floodlights. I'm young and happy. I'll never die. I'm skimming across the surface of my own history, moving fast, riding the melt beneath the blades, doing loops and spins. And when I take a high leap into the dark and come down 30 years later, I realize it is as Tim trying to save Timmy's life with a story.
Tim O'Brien lives in Texas. You can listen to this program again and find more information about him and his books at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Links to that information are also available on our Facebook page. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.